When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, Gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hill String Gang, Rango the Three.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to Bloody
Angola,
a podcast 142 years in the making.
Complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
And I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Overton.
So y'all, in our first season, we're going to jump right into it. In our first season of Bloody Angola, we made mention, I think it was, Woody, it might have been our first episode.
It was The Walls.
The Walls, yeah. That's right. And it was regarding women once being imprisoned at Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola. So since then, y'all, we have got messages often. I mean, you know, probably monthly about featuring the stories of some of these women as well as the history of what brought them there. So that sent me down what people refer to as rabbit hole.
Yeah, you do that so well,
right? I'm telling you. And this one was a little bit tougher than most for several reasons. One, as we've always told y'all, you know, prison information is not necessarily widely available. They kind of let you know what they want you to know.
Because, I mean, you know, it's a whole different world.
Right.
People just wouldn't.
They don't understand.
If they knew what the fuck went on inside of prisons, they would run down the street with a herald.
They would. So that was one hurdle to jump. But then another one was the amount of time. I mean, you're talking the mid-1800s when a lot of these women were at Louisiana State Penitentiary, even before it was known as Angola. So. Right. I did manage to get some information. That's what we're going to talk about today. So we got to go back, y'all. We got to go way back. We're going to start in 1847. Now, y'all, this was a different time in American history than, today.
For real. This is 20, almost 20 years before the Civil War even, right?
That's right. And people, you know, everything was different back then in any way, shape, and form you can think of. Right. But what you're going to hear, it's disturbing in a lot of cases. And you may even question, is that possible? Because it's just something that today would be totally unbelievable. But right. I can assure you this is not only possible, it is all fact. Right. And it's from a time that most people would probably rather forget, but it was a part of history.
Part of history, yeah.
And
made us where we are today, that's for sure.
That's right. So we're going to jump into it. And Woody, you know, you take it.
I will take it from here. So, y'all, the year is 1847, and Three different enslaved women found themselves living in the heart of downtown Baton Rouge. 25-year-old Rhoda had been born in Maryland and was the mother of a 2-year-old son named William. And 41-year-old Celeste had been born in Louisiana and had been previously enslaved on a plantation in St. Mary Parish. And 12-year-old Phoebe had been born in Mississippi but came to Baton Rouge from Plaquemine. Now, y'all, again, this is we're talking about inside the walls, downtown Baton Rouge. That's where the first penitentiary, I'll get to in a second. So all of these women were very different. In 1847, all three had one thing in common. They were all serving life sentences in the Louisiana State Penitentiary. And between 1833 and 1861, at least 35 women were in prison within the Louisiana State Penitentiary, which at the time, y'all, was located in Baton Rouge. And the majority of these women had received life sentences for a variety of crimes. Now, within the penitentiary, women were forced to work from sunup to sundown. And keep this in mind, this was the big cotton heyday for the South, and a lot of clothing, et cetera, was being made at the prison, and that meant money.
Yeah, it did.
Money, money, money.
And the South was rich
right.
compared to the North back right. then well, because of the cotton
that's right. plantations. And the North had industrial factories and stuff, which the South didn't have, but the South had the cotton, and that's cotton right. made the world go around back then, right?
High cotton, that's where that phrase came from.
Exactly. And anyway, but the conditions, y'all, and if you can imagine how bad they were in 1847, they were just absolutely horrible, and many of the women would die of disease, medical care and all that, probably not almost non-existent, and some of these women would even conceive and give birth to children while inside the penitentiary. Now, I know you're probably about to cover this, but if y'all go back and listen to the Walls episode, one of the most disturbing things about it is, if you're a female and you're locked up in prison in Louisiana State Penitentiary at the time, and you got raped, nobody got charged, and mm-hmm. you had a baby. The state took it and made it a slave. The state of Louisiana
That's
took
right.
the baby and made it a slave automatically.
That's exactly right. And we are later on going to get into exactly how that took place. Now, you know, imprisoning women in Louisiana State Penitentiary, y'all, was also something that was unique to the antebellum South. In the North, right. they just didn't do this as often.
Yeah, they didn't.
Women were.
It wasn't like they imprisoned them in the North and put them to work in the factories for free.
That's right.
Because they didn't have the slaves.
That's right. And so it was a unique situation here in the South. And sentencing to state penitentiaries was not, you know, common really at all up North. So Louisiana was the only state, believe it or not, in the Deep South to consistently sentence women to the state penitentiary throughout the mid-1800s. In many ways, the experiences of these women are a historical anomaly. Right. They're just odd things that you didn't see anywhere else in the country.
I don't know that I ever heard of it. A matter of fact, and I'm a big history buff like you are, I never heard of, like, this happening.
Yeah, it was not very well practiced at all, and they formed a population that was really exclusive to Louisiana and even more exclusive to Baton Rouge. So Baton Rouge in those days, the capital city of right. Louisiana,
right. The river docks were rolling. It was a big deal.
Yeah, they had a prison with big walls around it. And yeah. Go listen to the Walls if you hadn't, and that'll kind of set you up for this story. But they formed that population, and the intense just hardship these women faced and the uniqueness of their experience that makes them an absolutely critical part of the history of prisons in Louisiana and of Angola. Right. Even though it wasn't Angola yet, that's what it became.
Right.
And this is a sad but important part of that history. Now, despite the historical significance of the women in Angola, there's very little that you can find of their lives prior to that, during that, or even after they got released right. from prison. Right. Back then, women weren't allowed to keep diaries or document anything really when they were in prison. To
be honest with you, slaves, it was against the law for them to even read and write.
Yeah, that's right.
And that
very true.
That's what they were. We were slaves.
That's right. And most of what you can find, and you have to piece together kind of through old newspaper articles, letters from, believe it or not, military, you know, guys would write back home to their wives and things, especially during the Civil War. And they would mention this. And that's kind of how you got to the history of it.
Right. And so, like Jim just told y'all, Louisiana State Penitentiary was the only, basically Louisiana was the only state during that time to house both men and women within the walls, okay, within the same prison walls. According to prison records, the first recorded women sentenced to the penitentiary were Eliza and Sylvia. No last names were given during that time, y'all, who both arrived at the prison in 1833. Wow. The women were sentenced to life for the poisoning of their slave owner. Questionable at best. Maybe so. I don't know. They were both convicted on the same day in St. James Parish and arrived in the prison together. Now, what do you think of the chances? I'm going to go off on a tangent here. That two slaves from two different plantations just happened to poison what they call back then their masters on the same day.
Well, believe it or not, back then that was the most common way of acting out against your slave master.
Yeah. Wow, that's crazy.
Because you couldn't, as a female, you couldn't beat him up.
Right.
You know, so you just poison him because you're serving his food.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
So they would live in the prison, y'all, until Sylvia died in the late 1840s. And by 1855, the population of women in prison there peaked at the number of 18 of them, y'all, with the vast majority there serving a life sentence. Now, slaves, which made up the lion's share of these women, had a different form of sentencing than non-slaves. This was known as the Black Code. Now, the Black Code stated that a slave can be convicted of a capital crime from anything from murder to arson to simply hitting a white person. The majority of those women at Louisiana State Penitentiary during that time had been convicted of arson or poisoning, which in those days were the most common form of resistance among enslaved women, like Jim just told you about the poisoning part. And I guess the arson, they'd be like, I'm tired of cooking your shit. I'm going to burn your house down.
Yeah, and it was for these women, it was opportunity for them because they were the ones preparing the meals for these slave masters. It's the only way they could get to them.
I almost bet you a lot of that is just they may have had attitude and bucked up, and they just called the local sheriff and said, she tried to burn down lock her up for life.
Oh, but I'm sure there was a lot of that.
You're losing money.
You're losing money. That's right. And you got to, you know,
the horrible thing about slavery is that they were money. The people that they had to buy them and they bred it. It's just fucking horrible, but it's history.
That's right. And, you know, back then there was even controversy from lawmakers during that time on what to do with the women at the penitentiary. So, you know, even in those days, which was a horrible time period, y'all, in history, and a lot of these things that you're hearing, they're just horrible. But even lawmakers during that time couldn't agree on what to do with them. Some argued they should be sent back to their masters or put to work on a chain gang, which they had a chain gang, y'all, that actually operated out of New Orleans. Right. Rather than being sent to the penitentiary. Yeah,
chain gang. So chain gang was another way for the state to save money.
Yeah. You
know, building roads or whatever it may be.
That's right. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Miss Kitty, y'all.
Right.
And Miss Kitty was a woman from New Orleans who was sentenced to life imprisoning for, you guessed it, poisoning her slaveholder.
Right.
His name was Levi Smeltzer. And the poisoning occurred in May of 1855, going way back. Wait. But Kitty was not arrested for the crime until July of 1855. She actually confessed to a neighbor that she was put up to the poisoning by Mrs. Smeltzer and Adam Scott, who was a man Mrs. Smeltzer was having an affair with. Boom, boom. How about that? Side, and right. You didn't even think that went down in 1855, right. But not only was she having an affair, which back then that was serious, but she also wanted to kill her husband over it. This is according to Miss Kitty. And eventually Scott and Miss Smeltzer were also arrested in addition to Miss Kitty, and all three individuals were arraigned together on August 7th of 1855. Now, enslaved individuals in that time, like Miss Kitty, they weren't allowed to testify against whites. Yep. Kitty's testimony was not heard until after the verdicts for Scott and Miss Smelser had been determined, to ensure that her testimony was not illegally used to prejudice Scott and Smelser. Even when her confession was heard, Kitty was not allowed to testify herself, and her statement was given by the neighbor she had initially confessed to. So, according to Kitty's reported confession, Scott had purchased the poison himself. So, the guy that the wife was cheating with, he buys the poison. He gives it to Kitty to poison Mr. Smelser. Scott and Miss Smelser had promised to free Kitty by taking her to Kentucky, where she could escape to a free state. So they basically said, look, you poison him. We're going to drive you to Kentucky, or not drive you. We're going to horse and buggy you to Kentucky, and then you can just run off in the woods, and you'll be a free person. And she's down for that, as we all would be. So after suspicions started to arise over the circumstance of Miss Smelser's death, Scott and Miss Smelser locked Kitty in a room in Miss Smelser's home and planned to sell her to Texas.
So as a slave and make some money off of you.
Kitty figures this out, y'all, and Kitty manages to escape and runs to the home of a neighbor, where that's where she supplied that confession
Now that makes sense.
So Adam Scott, he's found guilty, and he's sentenced to life in prison in the state penitentiary. As the jury could not decide the verdict for Miss Smelser, she was released from the parish prison on bail, and they just never tried her again. They basically deadlocked and gave up on it.
And everything else.
So in March of 1857, almost 2 years after the poison, Kitty was tried before the New Orleans Slave Tribunal. Believe it or not, that's what it was called. And she was found guilty of
feloniously.
Thank you. Feloniously. I'm not even going to boom that out because that was hilarious. And of her own malice, poisoning Mr. Smelser and sentenced to life in prison in the state penitentiary. That's right. They probably ran into each other over there. Miss Smelser's lawyer actually attempted to appeal the sentence to the Louisiana Supreme Court on grounds that her trial occurred 5 days before a new law was passed that changed the procedures for slave tribunals. However, the appeal was denied, and she was received into the penitentiary on January 26th of 1858. Crazy. So that was when I came across that story, I'm like, this is a great one to tell.
I can't believe that paints a picture, doesn't it?
It's
amazing. So, and more of what Jim came across is, we gave you details on the walls, but listen to this, y'all. Let me tell you about the working and living conditions at Louisiana State Penitentiary at that time. Now, in the 1830s and 1840s, at the prison, labor was required. The state of Louisiana wanted to turn a profit from the prison, and there was no public funding at that time. Eventually, in the mid-1940s, the state started convict leasing to accomplish this, right? And we tell you about that in the walls. And they basically made an agreement with two individuals, Charles McHatton and William Pratt, that they would lease the convicts, and those two guys could keep all the profits minus the costs related to the prison, right? The housing and the feeding and whatever form of the guards. So most female prisoners were employed in the production of cotton in wool clothing and were required to labor from sunup to sundown. Now, for the white prisoners, forced hard labor within the penitentiary was designed to be a drastic change in their status and conditions, right? Imagine, like, this guy, Adam Scott, that did the poison. For the enslaved female prisoners, the wrongful ownership of their labor had simply been transferred to a different master, which was the state of Louisiana.
Now, let me just say this right here, because that's a good point you just brought up. What they were basically trying to say was, well, these slaves that are getting sentenced to prison, they're not, as ridiculous, y'all, and horrible as this sounds, the state was trying to say, well, they're already enslaved. They're already sort of in prison because they're slaves. They're already being made to work from, so there's no worse consequence for them. And, why send them to prison?
Other than now they're paying their own way. And so, I mean, makes total sense if you live in an 1830s house. So records indicate that for the most part, the enslaved women performed labor that was primarily gender-coded. A penitentiary report from 1839 lists 9 women employed as washers and menders for the penitentiary. Somebody's got to make the clothes.
Or and sew on buttons when they break.
Right. I mean, that's a real deal. And based on the convict registry for that year, 6 of those women were enslaved. Now, again, not even really any difference, right?
Yeah.
But records also indicate the women's labor in the penitentiary was not segregated by race. That's a big deal. A newspaper reporting on the conditions of the penitentiary describes how there are 4 colored women who work along with a white woman. Though these enslaved women were not treated equally, white and enslaved women working side by side shows that in the penitentiary, the racial division of labor was not as it was in the free world. Prisoners were prisoners for the most part.
And that's really interesting because in the free world, in free society, a white woman and a woman of color.
Unless one of them was the white woman's slave.
That's right. And, you know, they didn't do it is, you know, they didn't use the same bathrooms. They didn't live in the same houses other than the housekeeper. So for them to work side by side, even in prison, was strange. It was not something that was practiced outside of those prison walls, but inside the prison, you know, if your job was to mend clothes and sew on buttons and, you know, I'm sure they would do the patches. I'm sure.
Somebody had to cook.
They were right side by side and
put them together.
Yeah, that's right. So, very interesting part of this story there.
If you take it in the context of what the times were back then.
That's right. Then, now, Woody brought up earlier about children being born in the penitentiary. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. So this was more common, y'all, than you may think. As a matter of fact, between 1835 and 1862, 15 children resided inside of the penitentiary with their mothers.
Could you imagine?
With their mothers inside the penitentiary.
But you know what? That, you know, saves the state the money having to raise them independently.
Yeah.
And they get in, at some point, they're getting labor out of them.
That's right. Now, some of these children's mothers, they probably entered the penitentiary already pregnant. Records show a prisoner by the name of Jenny. And remember, they didn't use last names, and slaves did not have last names back then, what was known as slaves. Jenny, who entered the prison in March of 1859, gave birth to her son, Joe, the same year. And he went by the last name of Wilson. Maybe that was his slave owner's last name.
Yeah, a lot of it was they had the slave owner's last names back then.
So Marceline, which was a woman sentenced to 5 years for assaulting a white. Look, 5 years for just probably slapping a white woman who beat her with a belt or something, entered the penitentiary in 1853 with her 9-year-old daughter, Henrietta. So she brought her daughter to the penitentiary with her. 9 years old already. So there's more labor for the state is the way the state's looking at that. However, the vast majority of the children born in the penitentiary were conceived after their mothers were imprisoned. And in each case, the fathers of these children are unknown.
Right.
You can imagine.
Well, you know, everybody you look around and see got here because two people screwed, right? But back then, I would submit to you that the women and men housed together in prison, they were getting used.
That's right.
Getting raped.
And given that the female prisoners didn't live completely separate from the male prisoners until about 1856, so before that time, they didn't live separate.
Right.
It's possible that these children were fathered by some of those male prisoners. It's also possible that these children were fathered by the penitentiary's officers or leasers. You know, they leased them out, and these men, they worked in close contact with the penitentiary and would have access to these female prisoners. Yep. So,
and they weren't going to be calling it rape.
That's right. And not only did these women have to birth and raise these children in what we have already described to you as hard, very harsh conditions at the penitentiary, but they also had to watch as their children were taken away from them and sold. Mm-hmm. Imagine that.
Ripping from the arms. And
it's crazy to even wrap your mind around that, but that happened. And on December 11th of 1848, actually, the state legislature passed an act stating that all children born to women in prison within the state penitentiary would be taken from their mothers and auctioned off at the age of 10.
It just blows my mind.
That's a fact in history, y'all.
10 years old, you became a full-fledged slave for somebody else, and they bought you.
Louisiana State Legislature, it's an act. Look it up.
That's the way it was back then, yeah.
Yeah. The first of these auctions occurred on December 1st of 1849 when a 13-year-old by the name of Celeste and 10-year-old Frederick were both purchased by Charles McHatton, which was one of the penitentiary's first leasers.
Right.
So he actually bought those two. And from 1849 to 1861, 9 more children will be taken from the penitentiary and just basically auctioned off to the highest bidder.
That's crazy. As if
you're buying a piece of property.
Put them up there and then make them turn around and check the teeth and their bone, muscles. And then, the bidding goes up while you're standing there like a piece of meat.
Yeah, just insane. And most of these children, y'all, they were purchased by men that were closely affiliated with the penitentiary, like the leasers.
Right, they get first dibs, right?
First dibs, and opening up the possibility. Some of these children may be purchased by the men who actually fathered them.
Yeah, right.
How about that?
Yeah, exactly.
So a few of the children were purchased by prominent slaveholders from Baton Rouge, such as Priscilla, who in 1860 was purchased by a guy by the name of John Hill. And almost 40 years after he purchased Priscilla for $1,010, a lot of money back then.
Hey, that's like $1 million today, bro.
That's a ton of money back then. But John Hill was loaded. Right. And John Hill would donate actually $33,000, ton of money back then, to Louisiana State University as an endowment for what's known as the Hill Memorial Library.
That's crazy.
Azzeline, who was imprisoned in the penitentiary from 1839 to 1862, gave birth to 2 children by the name of Joseph and Emmeline during that time, and had to endure both of them being taken away from her.
So
horrible.
At the minimum of age of 10 years old.
Henrietta, who had come into the penitentiary with her mother, Marceline, was sold in 1854, 4 years after her mother was released and returned to their former slave owner. Mm-hmm. So she actually stayed in when her mother got released, and 4 years later, she got sold. Susan's son, Washington, was taken from the penitentiary and sold in May of 1861.
Right, beginning of the Civil War.
That's right. A year before, actually, the Union Army would actually seize control of the walls and eventually will release the prisoners.
Right.
We'll tell you about that in a little while.
I'm sure that was a shock to their system to see that. Y'all, the majority of the women in prison within the penitentiary received life sentences and remained in the penitentiary until the Civil War. But between 1833 and 1861, 11 women were actually released from the penitentiary, believe it or not. And 4 of the women who were released had received shorter sentences, ranging from 18 months to 5 years, and were released when those sentences were completed. Now, one of these women was Eliza, a 12-year-old girl who had been sentenced to 2 years imprisonment for attempting to poison her master and mistress.
Right? Another poison.
Kill both of them. 4 of the other women who were discharged from the penitentiary had been members of the Williams Gang, which was a group of convicts from other states that were brought into Louisiana to be sold in 1845.
The Williams Gang.
So since importing convicts for sale was illegal in Louisiana, These women were confiscated by the state government and placed in the penitentiary until their release in 1857. Mm. Always a loophole, right? And then, and so the remaining three women to be released from the penitentiary were surprisingly released by a governor's pardon.
That is surprising. That's back crazy. In those days.
Yeah, I may, you know, maybe they try to downplay it on how bad it was when the Union Army took Baton Rouge. But Phoebe, the 12-year-old girl who had been sentenced to life for wounding her mistress, was pardoned in 1857 after serving 10 years in the penitentiary. And Letty, who was a woman who was sentenced to life for attempted poison, was also pardoned in 1857 after serving 3 years. And lastly, Rhoda, who was a 17-year-old who had been sentenced to life imprisonment for murder, was pardoned in 1860 after having spent 21 years inside of Louisiana State Penitentiary.
And you had mentioned her at the beginning.
Right, right. And for each of these women, the exact reason they were pardoned, it's not known, y'all. But, you know, however, the practice of pardoning individuals was extremely criticized by the Baton Rouge public, which likely explains the rarity of such cases. And you get that because now, you know, they might get out and do something else bad. And when they're inside, they're making money.
They're making money.
They're paying their way. And remember, there was no tax-funded prisons back then.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Paying for themselves.
And, you know, when they pardon them, the public, like you said, will get pissed because they're, you know, put them in prison, now you're going to let them out. And right. It's just a different time, y'all. So different. Now, the outbreak of the Civil War had an immense effect on the lives of the women inside that penitentiary. Right. At the start of the war in 1861, the penitentiary's leasers returned control of the penitentiary to state government so that the convict labor could be used to aid Louisiana's war efforts. Right. So, you know, the South's in war against the North, and you actually have these prisoners, and they're making everything from belt buckles to bullets.
Right.
Right. Right. And yeah, especially in the South.
We didn't have the factories that the North had.
That's right.
That would be the reason we lost the war.
That's right. And from 1861 to early 1862, the prisoners were put to work. They produced clothing and cloth for the Confederate Army. And when Union forces occupied Baton Rouge in May of 1862 and later repelled the Confederacy's effort to retake the city in August of 1862, they gained control of the penitentiary as well. So that penitentiary, like we told you in the walls, it's in downtown Baton Rouge, right, surrounded. And when the, you know, when they really started to panic, as the story we told you in our very first episode, was when a cannonball actually went over the wall.
Shells start falling.
Yeah, and they're like, maybe time to get out of here. So as a result of them gaining control, the Union Army had to determine what to do with the penitentiary's convicts. So they take over the city, and they're like, well, we got all these prisoners.
We
got
to do something with them, right? It's our responsibility when we seize the city.
So the male convicts, a lot of them, many of them actually, enlisted into the Union Army.
Right.
I'm sure the majority of them probably wanted to.
Right.
To be honest, have you ever seen the movie payback. Glory, by the way?
Yeah,
go watch it if you ain't seen it. Oh, it's amazing. Ever. Denzel Washington's best work, in my opinion.
I agree.
Most of them probably wanted to, and the ones that didn't probably didn't have much of a choice. However, the fate of the 17, so you still have 17 women in there,
still locked up,
and four children, y'all, and they're held in that penitentiary. It's 1862. It's the middle of the Civil War. And basically the Union Army saying, what do we do with all these women and children?
Right.
So correspondence from the Union Army officers provided me a little insight into the fate of those women. August 16th of 1862, a Union captain by the name of R.S. Davis sent a letter to the colonel by the name of Halbert Payne. He was a commanding officer for the Union in Baton Rouge, and he was inquiring about the necessity of evacuating Baton Rouge.
Because they knew at some point the Confederates were going to try to take it back.
Which they did try to and failed, but he was right in the attempt. So Payne had apparently inquired about what to do with the convicts in a previous letter, because the response he received from Payne was to use his best judgment when he asked about the female convicts and in determining what to do with them. Right. However, in a P.S., Davis instructed Payne that whatever disposition you make of them, do not bring them down here, right. which was New Orleans, right. where he was stationed. Major General Benjamin Butler, who had been placed in charge of Union-occupied Louisiana, he didn't have a clear answer of what to do with the women or children either. And in August of 1862, Moses Bates, who was the Union superintendent for the Louisiana Penitentiary, sent a letter to Butler asking what he should do with the children in the penitentiary given the imminent evacuation of Baton Rouge. So Butler responds and he tells Bates to treat the children the same way he would any other destitute children.
Right.
Destitute. Interestingly, although General Butler stated that he could not condone Louisiana's practice of selling children into slavery, he did express that if these children were born of female convict slaves, possibly the master might have some claim.
Crazy.
Is that not?
That is so out the box.
So by September of 1862, the Union Army had evacuated Baton Rouge and abandoned the state penitentiary. Mm-hmm. So they just evacuate. Yeah. They abandoned the penitentiary. And despite Captain Davis' insistence, it is possible that the women of the penitentiary and their children were evacuated to New Orleans.
Right, because New Orleans was still Union held.
Yeah, and it is also likely that many of these women stayed behind, as records of another Union officer reporting on the penitentiary's inmates mentioned that a few were left in Baton Rouge.
Right.
So given that some those same records contain a detailed report of male convicts identified for enlistment and the white male convicts who were placed aboard a steamboat, it's pretty reasonable to assume that the enslaved women likely fell into the category of those left behind. However, what actually happened to these women and the children is largely unknown.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they didn't want to feed them. I don't know. That's crazy gap in history. You would think they would have took some to help assist with clothing. I don't know. I mean, you know.
I mean, these are human beings.
Right. But they certainly didn't treat them as human beings, right?
No doubt.
So, but and you know, look, y'all, after the Civil War, to determine what happened to them was even more difficult. And this is mainly due to the lack of personal information about these women contained in the penitentiary's records. And for the women who were still in the penitentiary when the Union Army occupied Baton Rouge, the uncertainty of whether they were left behind in the city or taken to New Orleans also complicates the process of locating them. And pretty much say nobody was really looking for them. But while the research in the records of the U.S. Census reveals several instances of individuals who could be one of these women, there is hardly any certainty in those claims. That just wasn't important to them, y'all. But they were human beings, and they breathe air, and they had names. And while apparently they disappeared from history, I'm going to read each name to you now because they mattered, and that is what this podcast is all about.
That's right.
And we always tell you that. So here are the names of the Louisiana State Penitentiary women and children. Eliza, Celeste, Joseph, William, Clara Williams, Jane, another Eliza, y'all, Washington, Henrietta, Letty, Eli, Cornelia, Kitty, Joe Wilson, Drozen, Sylvia, Mary, Emmeline, Carmelite, Emily, Melinda, Phoebe, Yvina, Marceline, Celestine, Hannah, Sophie, Sally, Sophie, S-O-P-H-Y, different spelling, Hope, Nancy, Azaline, Rhoda, Frances, Charlotte, Nancy, Susan, Celeste, Henrietta, Lucinda, Adeline, Hyacinth, Jenny, and Rose.
Wow.
Now, that's a lot. We're telling a story, but these were real human beings, women and kids. And
lost from history lost until from history. Right now. And, you know, we put it out there and just, you know, this is a part of history. I'm sure we would all rather forget, but even the ugly part of history, we all need to remember that. Thus, we're doomed to repeat it, as they say.
And that's a fact. The thing is, it's, you know, it certainly it wouldn't happen today. And that's because we learn from what happened in the past, right? And over the years, it's been slow improvements and everything else, but it did come around, right?
That's right. And I got one more thing to go over on this story. And that is something, it's just a little chart that shows, you know, the buying prices for these people. Crazy. And I'm going to give you a few of those. And of course, Woody told you about the $1,010 that John Hill paid for Priscilla. Celeste, she was born in 1836. Charles McHatton purchased her in 1849 for $470.
Wow.
In 1839, Charles McHatton purchased Frederick for $226.
It means they purchase it. They own them.
Yeah.
And literally slave them.
That's right. And he bought four of these people that ended up being slaves between 1849 and 1853 and spent everywhere from $226 to $800. There's a guy by the name of E.W. Willis who purchased a child named Peter. The mother's name was Marlieto. In 1859, $1,000 he paid. I would imagine that was for both of them.
Yeah. And well, you're right.
You know,
the difference is, you know, like, maybe certainly children would have been cheaper. The females would have been a little cheaper, you know, because they're working in the house or doing whatever. But they got, you know, the better, I hate to say quality, but that's how they used to grade them.
Yeah.
And put them on the auction like block, the slave block. That's a real deal, right? I mean, this is real history.
And you know, you think about it and you think, wow, it seems like it'd be millions of years ago. This was
just
three generations, four generations shy of life right now. You know, 1840s were only, you know, a few hundred years from that. It's just a absolutely horrible part of history, but an important, very important part of history. And I wish better records would have been kept at that time, but boy, I sure enjoyed researching it and bringing it.
See, I'm gonna give you an example because I just looked it up. $1,000 in 1840. Today, $1,000 in 1840 is equivalent in purchasing power to about $35,364.48 today.
Wow!
Right. That's an increase of $34,364.48 over the 183 years. The dollar had an average inflation rate. I'm not worried about that. But that's
35 times.
$35,000 is what it would take today. Oh, that's fucked up. But that's a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
A lot of money, and look, they were looked at as what can you turn in profit?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So it was a younger slave.
The younger slave.
Have them a while.
Have them for 20, 30 years and get more slaves off of them. They're females.
Yeah.
And whatever's born to them. Oh, that's fucking just crazy.
Crazy to think about. But
it's history.
That is history. And we hope y'all enjoyed it. Look, we want to thank all of our Patreon members, yes. Apple Podcast members, you know, you make this show run.
Yep.
We say it every week, but we can't tell you how important your support of what we're doing is. None of this is free.
Right.
It takes a lot of time from not just the recording, but the research of what.
And our numbers are constantly growing. So, I don't think we talk about this enough that, if you like this, and yes, we won Best History Podcast in the World this year, People's Choice. If you like the stories, that we have so many more that are locked up for
all Patreon. Yeah, we just did a bonus last week. That is fire.
Exactly. That was love. That, so if you want more, and then you get all kinds of different perks, choosing which levels or whatever. But if you want more, some of the best episodes we've ever done are Patreon episodes.
That's right. And hopefully all of you by now have received your quarterly gift that we give our highest tiers on Patreon. It was Bloody Angola podcast caps, right. And they were the skull caps. Yeah, the skull caps. And hopefully you enjoy those. And those were exclusive to our highest tier on our Patreon. So, thank you very much. Yeah. And we hope y'all enjoy that.
And we love and appreciate each and every one of you. If you get a chance, go take a couple minutes and leave us a review.
Yes.
Wherever you, listen to Bloody Angola, it helps. And also, unfortunately, in the podcast world, they just made some more changes. The big business people did.
Oh, yeah.
And if you were subscribed to Bloody Angola before, you need to go check to make sure you're still subscribed because they did some stupid stuff.
They think we're getting too many downloads.
Right. So they don't want they don't want you to get your automatic downloads anymore, but you go resubscribe again and you'll get them. So that way, look, you know, if something happens on Thursday and you can't listen, you won't forget about the episode that comes, because when you go to your podcast app, whatever it is that you listen to,
and
you'll turn it on, and the latest episode of Bloody Angola will be there.
That's right. And one last request, if you think about it and you're so kind, please share. You know, we post these drops on the Bloody Angola page. If you could just share that on your feed, so important. To what we're doing.
Like it and share it.
Yeah.
And the other people find it and it continues to help us grow.
That's right. That's right. So all love. And until next time, I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Overton.
Your host of Bloody
Angola.
A podcast 142 years in the making.
Complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
Peace.
I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hill String Gang, Wrangler 3.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.